Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress, and it's time for a conversation with our pal Andy Parks. Now, you know Andy from his great artwork with Phil Hester on books like Green Arrow when Kevin Smith was writing the book, Nightwing with Devin Grayson. But Andy's been a great writer in the last few years. Union Station was his first graphic novel with Eduardo Barreto. You might remember that was the first time he was on Word Balloon. The second time was to talk about Capote in Kansas, his great Oni book with Chris Somney. In the last few years, Andy's been doing a lot of writing for Dynamite Entertainment, books in the Green Hornet family, and also now, turning to Westerns, he's got a great series starting in March, The Death of Zorro. The Lone Ranger will be investigating the death of Zorro. It's a great crossover, and Andy is the guy in charge of it. We talk about that, and of course, can't help but detour into movies, particularly our old pal Orson Welles on this conversation on Word Balloon. It's all sponsored today by C2E2. The Chicago Comics and Entertainment Expo, coming back to downtown Chicago the 18th through the 20th at McCormick Place. Now, it's going to be on the west end of McCormick Place in a fan-friendly setup. I think you're going to enjoy it. And really, look at this lineup. Some of the people coming to C2E2, Patton Oswalt, and in fact, a full slate of comedians from Comedy Death Ray Radio will be there. Elijah Dushku, the cast from True Blood, cast members from Battlestar Galactica and The Walking Dead. You'll see a cast reunion of the TV show The Middleman. Remember that fine Javier Grillo Marsh comic book, a great ABC TV show? The cast is coming back at C2E2. In addition to comic creators like Adam Hughes, Brian Bendis, Matt Fraction, Gene Ha, Scott Snyder, Paul Cornell, so many more. Don't forget, if you get your tickets before Monday, March 14th, you can get the entire weekend for just $50. It's a great savings. But that's only until Monday, the 14th, and then you're going to have to deal with the on-site ticket price. Still a great value, a good time. It looks like there's going to be a great slate of entertainment. Rows and rows of Artist Alley. Last year was one of the biggest Artist Alleys I ever saw at a convention. You're going to see an equal amount of great people at C2E2 this year, and it's just 7 days away. March 18th through the 20th, McCormick Place, downtown Chicago. For more details, check out their website, c2e2.com. Let's talk Green Hornet.
Yeah.
You've been all over that Green Hornet world now for, it's like almost a year, right?
I think it's almost exactly, yeah. That about a year ago that Nick finally said, hey, you want to do something, let's figure it out. And maybe because of my Kevin Smith connection, he thought Cato would be a good fit. So I just wrote issue 11 of that book. So,
fantastic.
Yeah, it's been something like a year I've been working on it. And then I don't think I can say exactly yet, but my presence in Green Hornet world is going to be expanding here pretty soon.
Well, in addition, you did the Past Lives miniseries, correct? Or Blood Ties?
Blood Ties.
Blood Ties, yeah, excuse Blood me. Ties. Okay. Yeah, which was kind of the prequel to the Kevin Smith character, or the Kevin right. Smith story.
Right. And that was fun because they said you want to do, okay, Kevin sets up it right at the beginning of his book that Green Hornet and Cato have just wiped out the last of the mobs, they're going to retire. And they're like, do you want to tell the story leading up to that moment? So, I mean, they didn't give me any more than that. I was like, well, shit, that sounds like I can just write a gangster story, and I want to do that for sure.
Absolutely.
So I kind of got to channel my David Chase and just write a, you know, gangster era coming to a close kind of four-parter.
Well, and that's what I love about the original idea of the Green Hornet, you know, going back to the original radio show and everything, that it really was this, like, street show predating superheroes. You know, I mean, right. You had the Phantom, I guess, around, but this really was one of the first masked heroes, along with, you know, the Lone Ranger connection, again, through the same radio station. It was really a spinoff of the Lone Ranger.
Right. And I think Green Hornet's kind of cool because what sets him apart a little bit is that he's not as altruistic as some of the other guys. I mean, he has a code against killing, and he's definitely a good guy. But I think in pretending to be a wanted man and a criminal, I think that kind of allows him to enter that world in a, kind of a different way than any other mainstream hero. So that's kind of what I wrote about was, to bring down these guys, he's actually made deals with some of them. He tells one of the guys in the miniseries, look, if you feed us information that helps take out your competition, you benefit because you get to prosper until you're the last guy standing, and we benefit because it helps us clean up the city that much faster. So So Green Hornet kind of, you know, makes these mini deals with the devil along the way that I think makes him interesting.
And kind of in that same city corruption sort of way, was he kind of, you know, signing his own death warrant and making some of these deals?
He's always in control, the way I wrote it. The gangster is the guy who kind of ends up bitter about the scenario, because in the end, Green Hornet will honor his word, but when it comes time, you know, when that guy's the last man standing, Green Hornet says, "I don't really see that you have any leverage left." The guy has to go, "Shit, I guess you're right." So I keep Green Hornet and Kato in control of the situation.
Gotcha. Did you see the movie?
I did. I finally saw it with my kids on a snow day last week.
I finally saw it this week as well. I liked it.
I thought it was good. Maybe I shouldn't say I thought it was good. I thought it was entertaining, and I had a good time. I thought it was pretty dumb in a lot of places.
Understood.
But my kids and I really liked it. We even saw it in, you know, stupid 3D and all that, and we had a good time with it.
Well, and it was, you know, it was interesting, and I'm blanking now on the name of the director, but it's the guy who did Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, of course.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, I...
I wish I could pick you up, but I'm blanking too.
No problem. Well, I got the internet, so I can always look it up while we're talking here. But, no, I thought I thought it was, like you said, I thought it was entertaining. I thought it was kind of, you know, too silly for its own good at some parts. But I kind of went in with no expectations because of all the bad press it had, because it sat on the shelf for, like, you know, over a year. And was really kind of pleased. And even, you know, Christoph Waltz was fun. I mean, it's certainly not what he did in Inglourious Bastards, but it was okay. And, you know, also Edward James Olmos, as always, The Rock. I mean,
yeah, that was cool.
He's just like settled into this.
I wasn't expecting him.
Oh, I knew he was in the movie. It was, but he's really kind of settled into this, like, you know, kind of mentor role that it was pretty much Adama as news, you know, as Robbie Robertson, I guess, on, you know, at the Sentinel as opposed to the character he played. So no, it was good. I liked it.
And Christoph Waltz, is that the right name?
Mm-hmm.
Was the biggest relief for me, because I was like, oh God, I don't want that guy to be in something that's not entertaining or not well written for him. You know, I don't want him to suck anything, because I loved him so much in Bastards, and he really was fun to watch in Green Hornet.
No, I agree with that. Michael Gondry, by the way, the director.
Thank you. Good job.
And Jay Chou was a lot of fun as Kato. And it's also, I'm glad that, you know, he's got such a heavy accent, but I like that. And I, you know, it just made him that much more genuine, I think.
Right. I think so too. My least favorite part was really, I just thought Kevin's origin story was a lot more interesting.
I agree.
If you've been following Kevin's books, you know, having his dad be the Green Hornet and him not knowing about it and all that, I thought that was a more interesting way for the two new heroes to hook up.
No, I totally
agree. Kind of tied together through their lineage. In the new movie, they just kind of go, let's go out and get drunk. And then next thing you know, Seth Rogen's saying, you know, we should do this every night. We should be heroes. I'm like, what?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And yeah, and I mean, if anything, give a nod. You've got the license. Give a nod to the Van Williams, Bruce Lee stuff. And that's what I like so much about, you know, the fact that you are playing in that version of the Green Hornet universe that Dynamite is doing. Because, yeah, I do think that is there's something about a legacy character and stuff. And even, again, going back to, it, you know, the Hornet's ties to the Lone Ranger as well. I just think it makes it that much stronger of a character if, you know, there really is this kind of history. And, yeah, there's nothing wrong with the Van Williams, Bruce Lee stuff. I mean, I just think that, you know, they've been rerunning it on the Sci-Fi Channel, I think, leading up to the movie. And it was fun. It was a really fun, you know, kind of straight-laced show.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
And unfortunately, the radio show does not hold up.
I've never heard one.
It's not good.
Yeah, really?
Well, it's just of its time, and it's just creaky.
Yeah.
You know, Matt Wagner and I talked about that. I love what Matt is doing as well in the Golden Age version.
I do, too. Yeah.
So, no, I think there's a lot of fun there in the Green Hornet and everything. So that's good. I'm glad to see, too, that post-movie that Dynamite has more future plans with the license. That's good.
Yeah, they seem to really want to keep it going. And, you know, I kind of had my fingers crossed. I went through in ways that are kind of too complicated to explain. I had some possible financial stake in how well Scott Pilgrim did, and that didn't work out too well.
I thought,
boy, I hope Green Hornet does well, because, you know, they'll keep these books around longer, and it seemed to, you know, be a decently successful popcorn flick, so that's good.
Did you ever read the Now Comics run of the Hornet back in the 90s?
I tried to remember. I remember those books being around, but I'm not sure I read them.
Okay. Ron Frontier and Chuck Dixon among the writers. I know.
Is that right? I knew about Frontier. I didn't know about Dixon.
Yeah, Fortier, thank you. Yes, and I really thought they were entertaining. And, yeah, Chuck did more of the Golden Age stories.
Oh, and it was, I didn't know about that.
They kind of did the same thing that Dynamite did with the license, in that they told Golden Age stories, actually Golden, Silver, and Modern, because they really even went further and, kind of instead of Matt having his own way with the character in the 30s and stuff, it was like the radio era version of the Hornet was like the grandfather. Then there was the Van Williams character, and then the nephew of the Van Williams character is the one that kind of kept the thing going in the 90s. So, but they were always like nephews. I think they were always uncle, nephew kind of relationships. And it was terrific. And yeah, you had much like your guys' world and everything, there was a Golden Age Kato. Now Jai Nitz is doing the Golden Age Kato, correct?
He is, right.
Very cool. So, excellent. And, and much like your Kato and stuff, another female Kato in the Now version as well.
That's what I heard after I started working on this. Somebody mentioned that Now's version was a chick, too. It's interesting.
Is the Kato series that you're on, is that a finite series, or is it going to keep going?
Ongoing, as far as I know. They haven't told me they're pulling the plug yet. I've plotted up to 15 or 16, something like that.
Okay.
So... No end as far as I know.
And then, like you say, you've got another project that's coming up that they'll announce later in the year?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Very cool. So, and now...
Kato has been so fun for me that when they offered it to me, I wasn't exactly sure what I was going to do with it. And, at first I was kind of tied to what Kevin's continuity was going to be. And as I started working on it, I realized that, in large part, at least for me, the book was about that relationship between the two Katos. It's about a older guy than I am, but an older guy dealing with his daughter who's coming of age, kind of a different coming of age than I'm experiencing in my family, but I have a 12-year-old daughter in junior high now, and I'm dealing with that dynamic on a smaller scale, and that I really latched onto that, and I've had a great time writing that dynamic. I really enjoyed working on the book.
Has your daughter checked out the book at all?
You know what? I read them to my son, and he really digs them. And I just said to my daughter last night, you got to read this trade, and I think she's going to read it very soon.
Oh, very cool. So yeah. Of your kids, so your son likes comics. What about – and does your daughter read any comics or no?
She does not read much American stuff. I don't know how it happened, but I got one of these kids who's totally into manga and anime stuff and not so much into American comics anymore.
Very funny.
Yeah. But my son loves them all. He loves all the – The DC Kid books, we devour all those, Brave and Bold and stuff like that. And,
excellent.
And I shouldn't say Hannah doesn't read any American comics, because there was John Lewis was writing, I think it might have been a video game tie-in fantasy book for DC. I forget what it was called, but she devoured that. She liked that a lot.
Very cool.
So every now and then.
That's cool. Now, you got this big thing coming up does it start in the spring, the Lone Ranger and Zorro?
Yeah, I looked it up today. First issue hits in March, I guess.
Oh, very good. Okay, next month. Fantastic. Yeah. So, well, I was excited to hear this because, it's funny. IDW is doing the same thing with a lot of their licenses. There's a lot of crossover and stuff. And it's funny. I think we were all hoping once Nick got both the Green Hornet and Lone Ranger licenses that there'd be some sort of crossover or connection allowed there.
Yeah.
But I don't think anyone was expecting a Zorro and Lone Ranger crossover. But that's fantastic. Right. I mean, two masked Western heroes, you can certainly put them close enough in the same eras, and I don't think anybody blinks. But tell me about the project.
Well, Nick asked me if I'd be interested in writing something about the death of Zorro. So that was the first email. I was like, oh, definitely, yeah. And I'm picturing... six issues of Zorro involved in this epic struggle when he dies heroically at the end, and I write back, definitely, and Nick says, great. He dies in the first issue, and then the Lone Ranger comes to figure out what happened. Like, oh, shit, that's not exactly what I had in mind, but okay, I can roll with that. So, and then if I did a little digging on the timelines, at least in the Dynamite universe for these two characters, and, you know, their ages are, we're thinking 40-ish years apart, maybe a little less.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So, and Nick wouldn't let me cheat enough that they were both in their prime at the same time. So basically what happens is our story picks up with Zorro as an older man, retired, living a good, quiet life, and has a close tie to a Native American community near his ranch. And when something horrific happens to those people, he realizes that if he tries to get authorities involved, it's going to take weeks if any action happens. And in that time, these people will be suffering, so he needs to strap on the mask and the sword again and get involved. That doesn't go very well, which brings Lone Ranger into the picture to try to, one, get vengeance, and two, get justice for the Native Americans who are being wronged in the first place.
So, but the Ranger then is in his prime for this story.
He is, yeah. Lone Ranger is a young man. I kind of said it just shortly after his initial origin slash adventure story where he's, you know, going after the Cavendish gang and all that. We kind of hint at that right at the beginning of our story.
Cool. Well,
and there's a reason that I won't really get into that ties him to Zorro's story. I mean, he has a motivation for getting involved when he hears that Zorro may have been murdered.
And how much of, because, you know, I have to confess that I haven't been following anything that Matt had done recently. But are the, you know, is it Bernardo? You know, I mean, are the old players, you know, Bernardo was kind of Zorro's Alfred, his mute manservant that also, you know,
right.
Kind of a quasi sidekick, because, you know, there were times when, you know, Don Diego and Zorro would have to be at the same place, so, you know, Bernardo would be the guy that would put the mask on and at least, you know, ride by or something like that.
Yeah, right. That's an interesting point. I remember that from other media, and now that you say that, and Wagner will probably write me and say I'm a shithead because I got it wrong, but I don't remember Matt using that aspect.
Okay.
And I don't deal with it.
And I believe Garcia shows up in Matt's stuff, Sergeant Garcia.
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
So, yeah.
When we plotted this out, I kind of talked to my editor about, look, is this the future for the Matt Wagner / Dynamite Zorro? And we kind of, in coordination with Matt, said, this is a possible future of Zorro, but it's not necessarily the future for that character that Matt is writing. So I hate to call it like an alternate universe Zorro. That makes it sound like, you know, I'm writing a goddamn, you know, crossover for some major company. But it's this is not necessarily the way Matt's character is going to end up.
Okay. All right.
Like, for instance, he's married to a woman in our story that is not part of Matt's universe.
Oh, very cool.
Because we didn't want to tie the future of those characters into what we were doing. We want our thing to kind of stand alone without casting a shadow over what Matt does at all.
No, that's fair. And, you know, yeah, and really, I mean, God, and I know, I'm sure you feel the same way, you know, give Matt as much rope as he needs to, do his own thing and everything. I mean, my God, those Wesley Dodd Sandman stories were so great. And,
He's fantastic.
You know, and I'm sorry to see Madame Xanadu wrap up because I was really enjoying that as well.
Yeah, me too. Me too. He's a hero of mine and kind of a buddy. I don't get to see him very often. We try to get in a steak dinner once a year or so, but a good friend of mine and somebody I kind of feel like separated at birth of, you know, notions about because we're both big into food and drink and similar kind of lifestyles. I like Matt a lot.
No, I knew that about both of you, so it doesn't surprise me. And much like yourself and Phil, one of the incredibly gracious creators that I've, you know, gotten to kind of know at a distance through cons and who's always incredibly nice to me when I see him. And I'm just such a fan. And anytime I, you know, ask him to do an interview, he's right there. So he's –
Yeah, that's good.
And
nice to be compared with him in any way because he's definitely a hero of mine in the business.
That's and then exactly. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I was reading him along with you, man, when, you know, Grendel was happening and everything. So, yeah, that guy to have that kind of history and stuff like that, it just blows my mind. And I'm, I cheer him on because he's, he's always able to tell his own stories and stuff. I think that's great. So, but back to your story now, back to what's going on with your Zorro and everything. Well, this is interesting. Did you read that? I forget her name, the Spanish novelist that wrote that wonderful Zorro novel a few years ago.
I got to be honest, I did not read her novel, but I read the arc that Matt did that's kind of, I don't know how tightly it's based on her work, but it incorporates a lot of her ideas, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we use one of her principles in our story. She created, and then Matt used in his book, this La Justicia band of crime fighters in Europe, kind of a secret brotherhood that were part of Zorro's origin story. And they come into play in our story as well. I kind of pulled them from Europe over here to look into things as well.
That's cool. Well, what kind of background do you have with both characters, with the Lone Ranger and Zorro? What have you read? What have you seen?
It's going to be kind of embarrassing. I was not a Zorro guy as a kid. I definitely was aware of Lone Ranger and would see, it wasn't really my era, but I would see reruns of him, and I always dug Lone Ranger. I really liked that he had an Indian sidekick. I thought that relationship was really cool.
Yep.
Not a Zorro guy really until relatively recently. And I don't have, like you mentioned, I've got her name right here, Isabel Allende.
There you go.
Had not read her stuff. So really my recent exposure to him has just been what Dynamite's done with him, and I really enjoyed the hell out of both of those. So when Nick asked me about this, I didn't have any trouble picturing writing these characters in the same vein that Dynamite's been handling them.
Okay, never the top stuff with Don McGregor or, going back?
Oh, yeah, I did read some of that. Now that you mentioned it, I did, yeah.
I enjoyed that. I also enjoyed, of course, the classic Toth take on Zorro as well.
Right. I do have, I have those, and I've looked at them, and I'm trying to remember if I've read, I assume I read them at some point or other. I know I've looked at them a lot.
I also loved, and I came to this late, within the last 10 or 15 years when Disney started rerunning the Guy Williams, TV show. And,
I have not seen. Is it good?
I gotta tell you, for a 50s, show, it was great.
Yeah.
It was very, and it's John Robinson from Lost in Space, and he was a fantastic, Don Diego Vega.
That's cool. I gotta see those. Again, Wagner would probably kick my ass if I admitted I'd never seen those.
No, they're a lot of fun, and Bernardo is very, much part of the TV series. And, Ed Funicello was in the TV series, which is awesome. So,
is she really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I think post-Mousketeer, but pre-Beach Movies.
Yeah, right. Oh, that's cool.
So, the sweet spot of Annette Funicello's career.
Right. Yeah, I'm a big Guy Williams fan. I need to check those out. I always dug him on Lost in Space.
Yeah. So, no, I honestly highly recommend them, and I don't know. I'm sure Disney's got to sell DVDs of them.
Yeah.
But
I'll look around.
But, yeah, they're great. They're a lot of fun and everything. So, very cool. And, the Lone Ranger, my God, Clayton Moore. Sadly, I remember that 1980 film.
God. Yeah.
With Christopher Jim Ignatowski. Christopher Lloyd.
Yes, right. Oh, God, yeah.
Was Butch Cavendish in the movie. So he's a better
Clayton. I ever saw that. I don't need to go seek that one out. That's your recommendation.
That's terrible. It really is terrible. So, and, I'm kind of jaded because not only did I love the Clayton Moore series, but he came to a Toys R Us when I was like 5 years old. And I got to meet him, and he wore the outfit and wore the mask.
Oh, that's so cool.
And I'm certain meeting him, and also I think meeting Buster Crabbe when I was like 11. I think that's why I still like comics and as much sci-fi pop culture crap, because I really met these guys. So for me, it was like, holy shit, they were real. Especially the Lone Ranger when I was five. It's like that was like meeting Superman. I mean, it was like, oh my God, it's really him. So
do you remember? Was his suit kind of light blue, or what would you call it? Do you remember?
It was light blue. He had it was more of a leisure suit when I saw him. This is in the early 70s. And, you know, he was probably in his 60s when he did it and everything. But he looked great, and he had that voice, and it was just, how you doing, friend? And it was like, wow, that's really him. And I was just like, you know, stunned, just stunned. And shook his hand and everything, and they took a picture with me and everything. It was me and him. It was fantastic.
My dad has a story like that. My dad is almost entirely blind in one eye. When he was a kid, I forget what he had, some kind of disease. I forget what it was called, and almost lost one eye. He can just kind of see light out of it. Anyway, after that was all diagnosed, he had to wear an eye patch for a while to strengthen the other eye. I guess, or I don't know.
Okay.
And he went to a grocery store to meet Hopalon Cassidy.
Wow, William Boyd, cool.
And I guess when the guy saw my dad's eye patch, he likes, oh, this poor kid, and gave him special attention. And my dad still talks about what that meant to him.
That's fantastic.
I don't know, you know, 9-year-old kid in San Francisco. And, those little moments. And I think about that a lot when I'm writing comic books. I know there was a time in my life, my parents split up when I was in junior high, and that's a hard time for that to happen for a boy. And I needed something in my life. And comics gave me this cheap kind of escapism that I could really, you know, unlike a movie that I could really interact with. And I got involved in trying to draw, and it was just kind of brought this whole new world into my life at a time when I really needed it. And I think about that a lot when I'm doing my job. I want to be, I mean, it's a fun job. I can't complain. It's a good way to make a living. Well, not maybe full living, but at least half a living most of the time. And I think about it, it's important to me to do something that can maybe affect somebody like that. And like you're talking about Mean Lone Ranger, my dad met this guy. Those little moments in people's lives can make a big difference. I think that's really important and really cool to be a part of. And if you write a comic, you know, even once a year that makes a difference in somebody's life, that's a cool thing to do for a living.
Very cool, man.
Went off on a hell of a rant. I'm sorry about that.
No, I like it, and I understand what you're saying too. And you're right. And honestly, I think that's very cool that William Boyd was like that with your dad as well. So I mean, that's incredible. And I, you know, it's funny. I just seen within the last couple of years a documentary about Hopalon Cassidy, and they talked about how he really did like feel like an obligation to the kids. To be a good role model and stuff. Because he, I guess he was a silent movie star, and there was another William Boyd that was also a silent movie star, and it was kind of like Fatty Arbuckle, where he got branded on, like, some scandal, even though it was the other William Boyd, and it really screwed up his career. And, Hoppy really kind of brought his film career back. And as a consequence, and because he felt this obligation to the character, he's like, I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to lead a good, upstanding life, and really kind of became this, you know, impeccable role model. And, you know, and absolutely, like, you know, for the rest of his life did everything he can to be Hopalon Cassidy. I guess he was in the, you know, Los Angeles Christmas parade up until, you know, his declining years and everything, and would still show up and, you know. And God, you know, much like Daniel Boone, the Hopalon Cassidy, you know, phenomenon in the 50s.
Yeah,
which is
right.
Crazy.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
No,
oh
that's.
Oh, my God. I've, not that I'm fully focused on what you're saying, but I looked up The Legend of the Lone Ranger on IMDb.
The movie.
I've never heard the name of the guy that played Lone Ranger my whole life.
Do it. Say it.
Clinton Spilsbury. Who the freak is that guy?
Now, in fairness, we grew up with Clayton Moore, so that was fine. And I guess it's not that much of a reach in comparison. But you're right. Clinton Spilsbury, ladies and gentlemen.
And the man has one thing in his IMDb credit list here.
It was my understanding that they redubbed his voice for the film as well.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
I just remember, well, you know, at the time, that was a big controversy. Because the Clayton Moore association was so strong when they were making the movie. Not that he was expected to play the role, but the people that owned the license forced him to stop making personal appearances with the mask.
I remember there was a fight over the mask and all that.
Exactly.
He wore dark glasses for a while doing appearances.
Foster Grant sunglasses, exactly.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But you know, it's so funny. And I mean, put Adam West in that kind of situation with the Batman movie. Although now that I think about it, there was a smaller, like, outcry from Adam West that he wasn't involved in the Batman movie.
Yeah, he went, you know, like, I don't see why I couldn't play his father.
Come on, Bruce. Let's
explain,
go. But
this is a serious movie. We don't need snickering in the middle of our serious movie. Did you see Hollywoodland?
Yes, I did.
That scene where they have to pull him out of From Here to Eternity is so heartbreaking.
Yeah.
but that's exactly what they're thinking of when they're thinking about poor Adam West out there.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point.
I don't suppose you remember who played President Ulysses S. Grant in the Legend of the Lumber.
No, I do not. Go ahead, please.
Great actor Jason Robards.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow, I love Jason Robards. Battle of Cable Hill.
Me too. I love him. But that's one of those things where you go, you know, it's kind of what happened to my hero Orson Welles late in his career. Like, you know what? We need a little freaking credibility on this movie. Can we get Jason Robards come in for like 2 days, pay him $50,000 and slap him on the poster?
Let's talk about Orson for a second because I noticed in the last couple weeks, although I'm always skeptical when I hear these stories. But,
oh God, the other side of the wind again.
Yep, go ahead and tell everybody.
Yeah, I know. I saw that too. I've been going to Bogdanovich's blog and he only talks about old movies, but I was kind of hoping he'd mention this and he hasn't. You'd think he would have the inside scoop if anybody does, but yeah, like you said, every couple of years somebody says, "I think we got it out of the hands of the Iranian backers, and we out of his girlfriend's legal situation, whatever the hell it was." But I'm always a little skeptical. Now it seems like, did you know somebody on Twitter? Could have been Gabriel Hardman or somebody like that. Said they'd seen chunks of it and weren't blown away, but they were still hopeful for the whole thing.
Oh, I hadn't seen that. No, the only small pieces of it that I've seen were in that one Orson Welles documentary that Oha Kador, his former lover companion, narrates.
Yeah.
And that's and literally it's like just brief like moments of it, a couple seconds here and there. But for people who don't know and haven't, it's so funny that Orson Welles has kind of been circling word balloon for like the last 2 months because the Bogdanovich interviews came up during my talks with Fraction, and because he had never heard them. So and thankfully Siren Downey, one of these great word balloon listeners, found a blog that had all the MP3 files on it.
Oh, cool.
So I directed a bunch of people to that, and people have been downloading and stuff. And then of course with Parker and Gabe Hardman, it came up again. So, and then of course we get this news now. So, but if you don't know about The Other Side of the Wind, it was Welles' final film, and sounded really interesting. John Huston was the lead in it. Bogdanovich plays a role in it, and Oha Kador is in it as well, his companion. Yeah. But it's about this aging director who, it's kind of a film within a film where he's being, kind of covered for like a 60 minutes kind of portrait of the director. Plus he's making a movie and he's got kind of a young asshole kind of actor that he's trying to keep in line. And it sounds like a really, interesting idea. And he goes into detail about the story in those interviews with Bogdanovich. And, unfortunately,
fascinating is the – Orson and Bogdanovich were tight. I know they had their moments where they were, Orson would flare up about something or other, but I think reflected in the movie, there had to be some bitterness on Orson's part because Bogdanovich was blown up, had made, help me out, his first...
Paper Moon, Nickelodeon? Last Picture Show, of course.
Last Picture Show, thank you. And got big all of a sudden and was getting all kinds of offers, and poor Orson couldn't get anything made, raise any money. And I think I think The Other Side of the Wind is going to reflect what that feeling was for him. And I remember hearing John Huston say that he asked Orson, you want me to play this, Orson? What is it? And he said, you're playing this old guy. And then he paused in the middle of explaining and said, John, you're playing us. So I would love to see John Huston playing some kind of version of Orson and himself in that movie. That sounds great.
Absolutely. And they'd worked together before on Moby Dick in the 50s.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, you could.
Have you, I forget, have you seen the Orson Welles Stories from a Life in Film, the like 2.5 hour interview documentary kind of thing?
I think so. Talk about it a little bit more, but go ahead.
That's how my Orson passion first kind of blossomed. I saw it, must have been 1990, I think. TNT showed it. And somehow I had a VCR tape in, and I hit record and got the whole thing. Since then, I've acquired a digital copy somehow or other, and I made them for friends. If you've never seen it, let me know, and I'll get you one. But this British interviewer spent, God, I don't know how many hours with him, and it's just really fascinating, kind of heartbreaking. They walk all through his career, cover every one of the films he directed, get to the end, and, you know, Orson's talking about how it just didn't go quite like he thought it would, but there's this great moment. Just breaks your heart where he says, I could have been so much more productive in any other artistic endeavor. I had so many interests. I could have been a painter. I could have waited tables to, you know, make enough money to buy paints. I could have done this or that. And I didn't. I went into this business where you have to raise so much money, and it's hard to do, and it's frustrated me my whole life. And in the end, it's like saying, I shouldn't have married that woman, but I loved her. You know, what could I do? It's just amazing to see him be that honest about it.
And to be a rebel and kind of, and not by choice, because he wanted to work, you know, with studios and stuff, but it just bad luck seemed to follow him. And you know, some of his films that are now considered so brilliant, you know, were films that the studios absolutely hated. In some cases, the public hated it. Lady from Shanghai. Perfect example of that today is, you know, this wonderful kind of noir film, and all the public can think of back then is, you took Rita Hayworth, this beautiful redhead, and you dyed her hair blonde and you cut it.
Right.
Are you nuts?
Right.
But I mean, that's the kind of craziness that he dealt with. And then, of course, again, in the Bogdanovich interviews, he talks about how Harry Cohn kind of screwed up the musical score, and what, you know, should have been very powerful, you know, moments in the film, especially in the climax, are kind of, you know, conflicting with a very sappy kind of musical score. And, it, you know, that kind of drove him crazy. He won't claim The Stranger, another John Huston project they worked on. Huston was the screenwriter, and Welles directed it, and it was himself and Loretta Young. And it's a film that's in public domain, and it's on TV a lot because a lot of stations are in the area. And again, I think a very interesting film. But for whatever reasons he had, I don't know, you might know better why he disowned that film ultimately.
He says in this that long interview I'm talking about that he kind of made that film to show Hollywood that he didn't glow in the dark. And that it was him trying to be, he said, I wanted to show Hollywood I could stand there and say cut in action with the best of them. In other words, he tried not to be a pain in the ass. He made just a standard thriller.
Sure.
And for one, it wasn't, you know, it did some business, but it wasn't a huge hit. So selling out didn't garner him, you know, 20 years of being able to make his own projects because he'd made a huge hit. So it failed on that level. And I think he said, you know what, that's as close to whoring myself as a director as I ever want to be. And after that, he whored everything about himself except directing. He never directed anything again that wasn't personal to him. He, you know, even if, like in the case of one of my favorite films, The Touch of Evil, studio were mortified when they saw what it was and didn't put it out the way he wanted it. But that doesn't mean he hoarded himself making it. He made the movie he wanted to make, and then studio kind of yanked it away and fucked with it. Now, fortunately, in our day and age, we can see it the way he intended, which is great.
They recut it, and they were able to find, you know, footage and things like that. And they, you know, I mean, I remember when it came back out.
Yeah, it's funny. It's one of the few movies where the version you want is not the long one, because the studio tacked on some bullshit because they didn't think it was clear enough. So they made some assistant director film some extra shit, and you don't want that. So
I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah, you just get the one that says, you know, new cut or director's cut or whatever. I think Murch was the famous editor, was involved in the reconstruction. They were able to get it all put together again.
And God, yeah, what an amazing movie that is with Charlton Heston and Janet Leigh and Mercedes McCambridge. And I mean, it's
amazing. It's so fucking scary. That scene in the hotel is so creepy. And you remember Dennis Weaver is the scuzzy
clerk.
The clerk at the motel. Oh, he's so creepy.
Yeah, no, and Akeem Tamaroff. I mean, yeah, it's this like 1959, 1960 movie. It's notorious for its opening crane shot. That is just the long continuous shot that kind of like in for modern audiences, the same kind of thing in not Casino. Help me, Goodfellas.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. You know, I mean, since you got the idea. Go ahead.
I wrote a piece about that movie for Brubaker for the back of Criminal, like, I don't know, 4 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And I talk about that shot, and I say, when, you know, jerk-off cinema files talk about that movie, they'll inevitably bring up two things. They'll say, well, Charlton Heston played in Mexico, and it's ridiculous, and the opening crane shot is magnificent. And I argued in my little piece that I wrote for Brubaker, one, yeah, Heston's playing a Mexican, but he's a pretty good fucking movie star, and he's good in the movie.
Absolutely.
He certainly didn't kill it. And I think he's pretty effective in it. And two, yeah, that opening crane shot is really fantastic, but it's not the most impressive single-cut shot in that movie. The most impressive single-cut shot in the movie is in the suspect's apartment, and it's amazing because there's characters coming and going in this very confined space. And you don't even notice. And that's what Orson would have appreciated, I think. Orson, despite himself, sometimes could not help but draw attention to the filmmaking, and he does that in the opening shot. But what he wanted to be was John Ford. He wanted to be transparent. And that's what is so cool about the shot in the apartment. You don't even notice it's an uncut shot until you're paying attention to it. And then you go, oh, my God, they just played out this whole scene. He talks about in that interview I'm talking about, the studio heads were there on the set, and they're like, oh, my God, he's rehearsing all day. And they haven't shot anything. They haven't even rolled. And it was a scene in the apartment. And then finally, about 8 o'clock at night, they film it. It takes about 8 minutes. He says, cut, print. All right, we're 2 days ahead of schedule. The guy's like, what? Holy shit.
That's awesome. And, you know, you might have to rip me a copy of that. That'll be good because all I remember is all the comments that he and Bogdanovich talk about the film. And Marlene Dietrich is in the film. And, again, yeah. Dietrich is this, like, you know, I mean, these might be names that mean nothing to half of my Word Balloon audience, but I know the movie fans know what I'm talking about. But, yeah, I mean, really post, you know, 50s and stuff did very few films, and it was great that she's in Touch of Evil, and it's hilarious. In the Bogdanovich interviews, he talks about how the studio execs are in the viewing room, in the projection room, watching the rushes, had no idea that he had contacted Dietrich for this small role, and all of a sudden one of them was like, hey, that's Dietrich! Wait a minute! And they were thrilled.
I remember, if it's in the Bogdanovich, I know it's in this other thing. They said, they went to her and said, we didn't even know you were in this. What are we paying you? And she said, you put my name on the poster, you pay my full rate. You don't put my name on the poster, you can just pay me a little bit.
So, of course.
And they said, well, oh, yeah, we're happy to have you on the poster. So they paid her.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay, very good. I couldn't remember if she was on the poster or not. That's awesome.
She's got a heartbreaking, you know, that last line, one of the greatest
Some kind of man.
Farewell lines for a character. Oh, it's so great.
Oh, no, honestly, you know, and I'm part of this is an appeal, and that's one of the reasons why I talked to Andy and Parker and Gabe and even Fraction, who's a little bit younger than all of us. But the point is, honestly, folks, if you're not watching these great black and white films, you don't know what you're missing.
True.
And really, some of these performances are just incredible. And yeah, the Touch of Evil is a perfect example of that. There are so many amazing. Mercedes McCambridge, I mean, that's one of her great performances as well. And it's such a small role, but she's incredible. Like you said, Dennis Weaver.
Yeah, and you watch the movie, and it's really hard to conceive that in that era, a major, maybe it's not fair to call him a major Hollywood director, but a guy who made major Hollywood films made a film that is that freaking dark and twisted for, you know, seemingly for mainstream audiences in that era. It's really mind-blowing. That is a dark, dark film.
Well, and learn where these, you know, the Christopher Nolans, the Tarantinos, the Scorseses, where their influences came from.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the thing. It's like, you know, amazing filmmaking has been going on for 100 years, back to Georges Méliès. You know, I mean, and it's you get this great appreciation of what these guys were able to do, or now, and all. I mean, it's, you know, Dave McKean. I talked to him last year or 2 years ago now. I can't remember when he brought his paintings through town, because right now with his paintings and stuff, he's really kind of appreciating the very early silent era of films. Mm-hmm. Really, that like right after Thomas Edison pretty much invented it, what was going on and stuff, and just the inventiveness and the experimentation, just the magic that was going on back then and stuff. So
I got to tell you, you can cut all this shit out.
No, this is part of this is the good stuff, man. You know that.
I got to tell you one more well story, because Jamie Rich just emailed me about it the other day, and I'd never heard it before. So I'm sure you're familiar, but I'll recount a little. Orson struggled for, I don't know how long, 5 years maybe, to make this version of Othello, which turned out to be brilliant. And that's another thing that's been restored now. You can see it just the way Orson intended you to see it. Just go get the DVD. It won the grand prize at Cannes, but didn't have big success in America. Well, he struggled to make this film. All the financing fell through. Costumes weren't paid for, had to be pulled away, all this stuff. He put stars up in hotels across Europe, and he'd go off and he'd appear in some piece of shit as an actor, rush back with his $100,000 he just made, and he'd shoot a little more. And this went on for years until he finally got the movie made. Well, Jamie Rich just told me that he heard a story, I think it's from the guy who shot parts of Othello, I don't remember, somebody that had worked on it. No, I know what it was. The guy who shot the movie The Black Fox or Black Foxes, something like that. Orson plays, typical heavy in it, bad guy king or whatever the hell he is. Well, Orson showed up to do this film in the middle of trying to make Othello. And Orson says, look, if I'm going to play this part, I need a mink stole thing around my waist here. And they go, what? That's not going to be on camera. I mean, the way we're going to shoot this, that's not even going to show up. I refuse to go on until I have this mink. This is what the character would have, and this is ridiculous. And I will not go on until this is acquired. So they go, and they find him this fucking mink coat, and he wraps it around his waist, and they shoot the scene. And it's never in the film. Orson leaves the set immediately after shooting, taking the mink with him. And it's a major piece of his Othello costume. He had a fit so he could steal this thing and put it in Othello because he needed pieces of his costume. Jamie sent me a great publicity shot of Orson as Othello leaning over the bed about to strangle Desdemona. And you can see the mink stole around his collar. It's fantastic.
Well, that's the great thing, and it's, again, you learn these things from the Bogdanovich interview and from the documentary you were talking about as well. This guy really had this kind of gypsy guerrilla filmmaker mentality and did anything he could to get his projects going, and that's why every one of these, you know, handful of films that he made, I mean, really, at the end of the day, did he make 10 films?
I want to say if you count every single thing, and one of them I've never seen.
Which one?
That it might be 12.
Which one haven't you seen?
It is called, hold on, I'll look it up. It's a European thing based on an old proverb about a guy who comes to an old man's house and ends up kind of maybe sleeping with the guy's wife. Hold on, I'll tell you what it is.
Okay, while you're looking it up, They're incredible. They really are interesting. And, yeah, you find out the backstory of what it took to make these films. Like you were saying about it was Othello that they couldn't make costumes. And, in fact, it was the Superman producer, Salkind, that was the producer of the film. And he's like, listen, I'm sorry, there's no money for – or no, actually, now I'm confusing those. That might have been the trial that it might have been – he might have been the producer. But regardless, they had no money for costumes. So – Wells got smart and decided to shoot two reels in a Turkish bath. So everybody, exactly. it's essentially just has towels on him and stuff, and you could get away with it. You know, obviously they made it as period as they could, but that was how he solved not having to have costumes. He shot two reels in a Turkish bath, you know.
He shot the murder of one of the characters that takes place. He just said, well, if they're in a bathhouse, they won't need costumes. And it ends up leading in this chase through the sewers of Venice or wherever the hell it is, and it's a stunning, beautiful scene. So.
Yep. No, incredible, man. I'm a huge fan. Now, you know, and here's another thing people can look up. I always mention these; they're amazing, and I'm sure we've talked about them before as well. If not on the air, then certainly in passing at conventions. But the Television Academy has these amazing oral history interviews, and two of the principal writers of the Dick Van Dyke Show were Bill Persky and Sam Denoff. They also created That Girl for Marlo Thomas.
Oh, wow.
Now, they did a project with Wells in 1969 or 1970, and it was a television version of a very famous play called The Man Who Came to Dinner. And and Wells, you know, is in the film, or is in this television thing. They shot it in London, and but they had an American and British cast, and they were talking about casting with Wells, and they said, you know who will be excellent as the doctor? For a comic relief part is, and they said Don Knotts would be perfect for this. And Wells said, who is Don Knotts? And they're like, are you kidding? They're like, he's Andy Griffith. They're like, for the last 10 years, he's won Emmys. He's this amazing actor. He's made films. He's very funny. He's very popular. And like, well, you know your world, you know, if you say so and you say he's a good actor, I'll take your word for it. Well, he has this great scene with Wells. And it's just another typical Don Knotts as a hick kind of scene. And he's just electric in the film or in the scene. And Wells can't hold his shit together for these takes because he's dying and laughing. And like the second day he takes the producers aside and he's like, this man is a genius. This man is a comic genius. And he discovers Don Knotts for his, you know, his own amusement. And he's like, it really, they're like, on the one hand, they were thrilled and thought it was awesome that a guy from such a different background can appreciate Don Knotts and right. get exactly why he's great. But also, it was a pain in the ass because they couldn't finish a scene. And Knotts was also incredibly, you know, thrilled that Wells thought so much of him. But he's like, it was kind of embarrassing because really, you're marvelous. You're incredible. You know, he was fawning over Don Knotts and how great he was. And that's just so neat that, like, Orson Welles, like, you know, discovers Don Knotts in this way and just loves him and thinks he's awesome. So,
remember, is it in the Bogdanovich interviews or something else where Bogdanovich talks about what Orson's favorite TV show was?
I don't know. What was this?
He was staying with him. He was living at Bogdanovich's house. And Bogdanovich said every day he would run through the living room because the rerun of the Dick Van Dyke Show was going to be on.
Oh, that's cool.
And he thought it was just brilliant. Couldn't wait to see it every day.
It does a shot. Well, he loved those guys, and it's so funny. Both Persky and Denoff do separate interviews, and they talk about the man who came to dinner. And it was Sam Denoff who told the Don Knotts story. But with Persky, like, yeah, he's like, I guess the rest of the actors really felt that Wells was a pain in the ass. And they kind of defended him because they admired him so much, and he really admired them. And it must be also because he loved the Dick Van Dyke Show, because, you know, he just thought they were excellent producers and writers and stuff.
Right.
So they really, you know, it was very interesting to hear Persky in particular just talk about, you know, what a privilege it was to work with him and how cool of a guy he was and everything. So
that's cool.
Yeah, pretty neat stuff.
How did you see that? Is that available somewhere?
It's on YouTube, and if you go to the Television Academy, if you just look up TV Legends on YouTube and look up either Bill Persky or Sam Denoff, you'll find their interviews. And again, Denoff tells the Don Knotts story, and Persky talks about the production as well. But yeah, they're incredible. I mean, you know,
seen the actual Man Who Came to Dinner? Is it around?
I can't find it. I hope to find it someday. It's got to still be.
I'm looking at how it's made for TV in 1972.
And I think it was Hallmark, I want to say, that they made it for Hallmark.
Interesting. Lee Remick's in it.
It ridiculous cast, all-star cast, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I want to say Joan Collins is in it too, right?
She is, yeah. Marty Feldman. Don Knotts, Michael Go. How do I know Michael Goff or Go? Or
isn't that no? I was going to say, isn't that?
Oh, he's Alfred. He's Alfred in the Burton Batman movie.
Right. So, it was this amazing American-British cast.
Yeah, that sounds cool. See, and there's an Orson thing. I've never seen his, is it called The Fountain of Youth, the thing he made for TV?
Yes.
I've never seen that.
Those are on YouTube.
Are they?
Yes.
Oh,
yeah, these short films that Wells was trying to kind of make as a television anthology series. Against something.
Oh, you're not helping my deadline situation here.
Again, Wells is just this amazing, fascinating guy that, as you say, yeah, is like, it's interesting. And again, I can appreciate his frustration about his success in film because, while he was doing that, he was rattling off these radio shows. And really, he even says it in the Bogdanovich interview, the biggest thing he ever did really in his career was radio.
Yeah.
And and he was right there at the golden age of radio from the start right to the end. And making incredible programs. His Third Man radio series still holds up. And I mean, if you like the
movie, it's amazing. Yeah.
Listen to The Lives of Harry Lyme. It's just fantastic. And it's so funny because you hear him in these interviews say that he, was just a cold reader, would literally like pick up a script and read it, was not interested in rehearsing at all.
Well, you got to see, you've probably seen it, but me and Orson Welles shows that so brilliantly. He walks in. They say it's an old, whatever ethnicity it might be. He says, how old? They tell him, okay, give me a script, and he goes. It's amazing.
There's a Laffin sketch also on YouTube where he kind of does a self-parody of himself doing a radio thing, and you should watch that. It's pretty funny. But no,
I'm not sure anybody ever had a career like Orson's to the age of 25 or so.
Exactly.
Because the guy made the most controversial, best-known radio show of all time. He'd had these huge successes on Broadway. I mean, if you give me any night, one night in time to go back, I might go back and see the opening of the quote-unquote Voodoo Macbeth, which by all accounts was just one of the most miraculous things that ever happened on Broadway. He had these huge successes on Broadway. And then went out to Hollywood, got carte blanche at a major studio and made Citizen Kane, and he's like 25 years old.
Yep.
It almost makes, it makes somebody my age go, what the hell have I done?
Well, it reminds me of when I hear, and it really irks me, but a lot of times, and I'm picking on my fellow podcast brethren, but sometimes they'll talk about a comic artist and talk about them today drawing something and saying, that just can't hold a candle to him in his prime back in the 70s. And it's like, that was 30 years ago. Right. I'm like, I have a feeling that it might be tougher to kind of hold the pencil still at 65 or 70 than it was when he was 25. You'll forgive him. It really does. It gets me really angry. And you're right. Wells had that kind of thing of, hitting this high note of Citizen Kane, especially. And as you say, all the Broadway that, people didn't see. But, the one example that still exists, the two, really, I guess, Kane and Magnificent Ambersons. And was kind of chasing the ghost and his own reputation for the rest of his life.
Right. And people love nothing more than to tear that guy down. That 25-year-old, Wunderkind, people love nothing more than to see that guy fall.
Yeah.
And that's a lot to carry around for the rest of your life. And I think that it's easy to kick Neil Adams now. Neil Adams throws himself out there as a target as much as anybody. And he God bless him. He does not hide. He'll tell you his wacky theories about how the gravity on the earth works or whatever the hell
he's done it on Word Balloon. Absolutely, sir.
and he puts himself out there, and I think he's not the artist he once was, and I don't think he's much of a writer, and I don't enjoy his work like I did, 40 years ago. Well, not that I was reading it 40 years ago, but the work he did 40 years ago. But, God bless him. He's still out trying stuff that's important to him, And it's not easy to be the 18-year-old guy who takes over Ben Casey and is like the greatest strip artist anybody's ever seen.
There you go.
It's that's a lot to carry around the rest of your life.
Well, and just – but, you know, I don't know. I don't know how you feel about it, but for me, rather than having him compete against the 1970 Neil Adams or even the 1965 Neil Adams doing Ben Casey or whatever, or 1962, whatever it was, you know, I think it's let's follow the artist on his journey. I am interested in what he's doing now, and I would rather – more so than in music, because I think it's tougher. Because, like, I look at some artists like Paul McCartney and people like that that I understand. I kind of have that feeling, too, of, man, I suffered through a lot of his albums from the 90s when I was, you know, working at the sports station and at the rock station. And I'd just roll my eyes and go, oh, that's so sad. But for an artist, I don't know. I like being on the road with them, and I feel the same way about filmmakers as well. Even failures like you know, that terrible film that Woody Allen made, Scoop, with Scarlett Johansson and Ian McShane, just a terrible movie. But again, there's just part of me that I'm just so curious about the artist as much as the art that I am willing to go on the journey with them and just, you know, ride along shotgun and everything and kind of see it happening.
Not everybody goes away at their peak, you know. Not everybody has that luxury.
Of course not.
And Orson himself said in an interview near his death, kind of ruefully, he said to one of his friends, "Oh, how they'll love me when I'm dead."
Yeah.
And I think he knew these motherfuckers will not give me, you know, $2 million to go make a movie, but when I'm dead, they're going to line up and say, "Oh, what a genius."
Yep. Yep, I at one of the flea market kind of conventions, I found a DVD of a bunch of Merv Griffin talk show clips of celebrity interviews, and it had the Wells interview because he did an interview with Merv literally hours before his death.
Right, I remember hearing that. Yeah.
And it's really, God, he looks like hell, obviously, because it is the last hours of his life. But it was really interesting to hear, and I guess he, you know, even told Merv, he said, you know, I've been on before, and I've kind of hesitated talking about the old movies. He's like, tonight I'm willing to reminisce, Merv. And it was a really neat interview. And another one, and again, another thing you can find on YouTube, check out his early 70s Dick Cavett interview.
I feel like I've seen that. I'm a big Dick Cavett fan. He's kind of a blowhard, but I love the little bastard.
I do too, man.
Yeah, there's some great stuff with Truman Capote in him. There's an episode of Cavett that has Truman Capote and Groucho Marx, and Marx is loony as a just batshit, and Truman seems like he's loaded, and I don't know, pills, booze, whatever, but he's not afraid to tell Groucho he's full of shit. It's really a pretty fascinating half hour or so.
And of course, for people who may not remember. Ange's connection with Capote in Kansas, that wonderful book that he did with the very young Chris Somney back in the day. Boy, that's
taking credit for Chris's whole career.
You should.
From now on.
I remember when we met. I met him at Wiz Chicago, and it was right after Capote came out, man.
And it was a year before that where he had done, I don't know, 4 or 5 sample pages from the beginning of the script, and. He came up to me at Wiz Chicago and said, "Hey, I'm the guy who did those pages. What do you think?" And I said, "I haven't talked to Oni yet, but I think they're pretty freaking good, and I don't think we're going to do any better. So I think we're going to make this happen." And yeah, he was pretty freaking good. And you know, he started out pretty good at the beginning of our book that we did together, and at the end of 120 pages, he was already quite a lot better. And he's one of those guys that works, you know, nothing is more important to him than that piece of paper. And he works long days and really dedicates himself. And he's turned himself into a pretty amazing talent.
Absolutely, man. No, it's the reason why we all love his stuff and enjoy watching him evolve. I was wondering, though, and it was going to be part of my questions to you, given your graphic novels that you've done, your original graphic novels. Are those available digitally yet?
You know what? I don't know. Not as far as I know. And I don't know what Oni's plans are, if they have a program for releasing newer stuff, but they haven't put them out digitally as far as I know. There was a pretty recent reprinting of Union Station, so it's available in book form. And Capote is out of print, but there may be big plans about a year away that I don't want to comment on too much. It may be back in print somehow in the next year or so.
Terrific. And I was, because I was wondering about that. I didn't, and I know you've got a good relationship with Oni as well. And,
yeah.
You know, I wasn't sure if after a while that stuff was going to revert back to you or if, you know, again, you've got a good relationship with Oni and you're very happy with them kind of being your partner on those things.
Yeah, I am. I like working with those guys. And, you know, it's a good question. Between you and I haven't looked at my contract in a while. It's been so long since Capote came out that I'm not sure what the rights, publishing rights are now. But we've spoken about a way to get Capote back in print that I'm excited about. So I think that's going to happen, and that'll be cool. And, you know, I would kind of – I'm torn. I like to read stuff. I've discovered I really like to read books on my iPad, and I think it'd be cool to have the books that way. But every publisher approaches that a little differently and kind of respect how they're going about it, I guess.
Because even in particular, I thought Capote would look good digitally. I love Union Station as well, and I think it would look fine. But Capote, I think, has that kind of sparseness that I think would
it
look
does.
Good.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, and then that's the thing. Such a departure from where Chris's art is now, and especially in his kind of Tothian stage, if you'll forgive me, Chris. But
yeah.
And I'm sure he would agree. He would agree. But that's the thing. It's interesting to see where that art was and where he is today.
It is. Yeah. He's an amazing talent, and he just, like I said, he works his ass off. There's nobody in comics who's earned his success more than Chris Somni, I don't think.
Now, you've been busy. As you say, your convention schedule is going to be kind of light this year. You're only doing Planet Comic Con and with Chicago, we were talking about before we started recording. And that's because you're heavily involved in writing a new original graphic novel?
I am. I've written one that got some press about a year ago because it got optioned by Paramount. It's a thing called Ciudad, which is a South American crime story, and that's being drawn. I'm not sure when that'll be out. The artist has a lot on his plate, so he's working at it. And then I have a new thing that I'm just starting work on, and again, I hope will be done by the end of the year or so, assuming my very talented artist can keep up. So hopefully in 2012 there'll be one or two, you know, there should be a lot of creator-owned stuff out there for me again. And I'm embarrassed. It's been too long, and there are a lot of circumstances that come into play. You know as well as I do, there's not a ton of money involved in these things, so it's tough to get them done sometimes and still keep the lights on. But it's been too long since the last one. I need to get stuff out there again.
Well, and I mean, that's the thing. We're in transition with digital right now, Ange, and I know that it is at the beginning of this digital comics era, but I really think books like yours in particular that aren't, you know, superhero books necessarily, but just good, strong mysteries and genre pieces, historic fiction in some cases, I really think they would find a real mainstream audience as opposed to just the comics mainstream audience. So, you know, especially when you see the success of things like, you know, Darwin Cook and what he's doing with the Parker novels and things like that, you know.
Right.
Am I saying it right? Is it Parker?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, I just.
And that, to be honest, that's what excited. It's why I was an early adapter on the iPad. I'm really excited about comics available at the, you know, at download speed to a wider market. And I'm very interested, with all due respect to my publishers who I adore and who've done a great job for me, I'm very excited about making that distance between creator and reader a lot more direct.
Understood.
And that's exciting. And I don't know if you've been following Scotty Young on Twitter, but he's kind of jumped off in that direction. And that really fascinates me. I'm watching what he's doing very carefully.
Yeah, Scotty's a friend, and we've been talking about it, and he'll be coming back to Word Balloon pretty soon. I'm thrilled with what he's doing on the Oz books with Eric. But no, he's been talking about doing his own thing for a long time. And I'm thrilled that he is doing that stuff as well.
The delivery method that he's using is very interesting. You know, not everybody may be aware of it, but he's not doing it within the iTunes model. He's kind of found a different way to do it that's a lot more direct. and the numbers are not huge, but you start off at a place that's, you know, respectable. If you can build on that, and if you keep the material flowing, it can turn into something. That's exciting.
Well, and that's, you know, I don't, you decide, Ange, if you want to comment on this, but this gives me an opportunity to talk about it because it's in recent memory. Eric Powell's video from just a couple weeks ago. I appreciate where Eric is coming from, and I'm guessing that most Word Balloon, you know, fans are aware of what we're, you know, talking about in terms of Eric's plea for more attention to independent books and things like that. But I really think that unintentionally he was a little too preoccupied with what Marvel and DC were doing with their share of the marketplace versus being inventive the way Scotty is and really just, you know, focusing on doing your own thing, creating your own books and you know, kind of forcing your own way into the marketplace. That's why I think, you know, in comparison to his frustration, you know, Scotty's a little bit smarter in what he's doing. And again, I'm not trying to piss at Eric at all because I'm a big fan of his. And again, I appreciate where he's coming from, but I think he would have pissed off. And I think that's one of the reasons why he made a video for people who don't know that kind of got a little angry. And I think, you know, he very wisely pulled it after he saw kind of the backlash that happened.
Right.
So,
and I don't care about the, you know, risque humor or anything like that. But yeah, it was maybe a little more negative than it needed to be. And it touches a nerve with guys like me that Eric Larson touched, God, I don't know when that was, 4 or 5 years ago when he kind of said similar things, and Robert Kirkman has touched. And
sure.
The nerve is, yes, I'm trying to do creator owned product and get it out there. The problem is, it's hard to do that and make a living wage in this country, the way the comic book industry has developed. I'm not 20 years old living in my mom's basement and not living on very much money. I got to make some kind of living. I got a family to help provide for.
Absolutely.
Thank God my wife has a real job and has health insurance and all that kind of stuff. So I don't have the burden that some guys have. But still, I'm a grown-up who has to lead a grown-up life. So I have to find a way to pay the bills at the same time I'm trying to develop creator-owned work. And that's a tough balance. And people, I think, don't often understand how hard that is. To be honest, it's easier now that I'm only writing, and it's really the reason I wanted to make that transition. It was hard for me to be a 80% inker and a 20% writer and really just kick in the writing chops and get to work, you know, like ink 6 hours a day and then run over and do 2 hours of great writing. Hard for me to flex those different muscles so effectively, so quickly. And that's why I said, you know, being an inker has been a good career for me and it supported my family for a long time. But as I'm getting older, I want to be involved in stuff that I own and I have a stake in and that I'm developing as much as possible, and I don't think I can be the best writer I can be until I'm doing that full time. So while I'm still writing a lot of creator-owned stuff, work-for-hire stuff, I'm honing my skills as a writer. I'm writing every day, producing a lot of product, and you don't get better at something by not doing it. And I feel like I've grown a lot as a writer in the last year of really learning how to write monthly comic books, and I think that'll make my creator-owned stuff stronger. And, you know, the dream is that someday you're Robert Kirkman and you're writing all stuff that comes out of your head and you're the person who benefits if it does well.
Well, and I'm happy. I didn't know about the movie option on the South American Crime Story, so that's great. Since Union Station, I've been a fan of your writing, and I agree with you. I think you've only gotten stronger. So
I appreciate that.
Well, and I'm glad these opportunities keep coming up, man. And as you say, I think you're going about it the right way. For people who haven't checked out Union Station in Capote in Kansas, do yourself a favor. Ange is one of these guys, just like Jeff Parker and Gabe and Fraction, that I know a lot of Word Balloon listeners, you know, we all like the same stuff. And, you know, it's reflected in your writing. And I think, if you haven't had the chance to check out Ange's stuff, now is the time. And that's one of the reasons why we have Ange on today. So thank you, my man. Thank you. Thank you for the tangents, and looking forward to seeing you at the very least in August.
Absolutely.
And
that's that one, right?
Exactly. No, it's in my backyard, so I'll see it. I'll see you at Chicago Comic Con. But we'll talk more Orson Welles and the like when we see each other.
Good to talk to you, John.
That's Andy Parks. Don't forget, starting in March, it's The Death of Zorro, the Lone Ranger Zorro crossover, and Andy is the writer of that. Can't wait. And make sure you check out Andy not only in the pages of the Kato series, but also in Green Hornet Blood Ties, which was the prequel to the Kevin Smith Green Hornet story. This episode of Word Balloon was brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. There's a wide variety waiting for you of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, absolute editions, omnibus editions, original graphic novels at greatly reduced prices, sometimes as much as 50% off the cover price. Great values for Andy Parks from InStockTrades.com. Union Station, the graphic novel, there's a new edition that has great background material as well. It's Andy Parks and Eduardo Pareto. The standard retail price is $11.95 at InStockTrades.com, $8.37. You can also check out the first volume of Kevin Smith's Kato, written by Andy Parks, Not My Father's Daughter. The standard retail price is $19.99 at InStockTrades.com, $13.99. Check them out. There's great deals waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. John Sutcher saying thanks, as always, for listening to Word Balloon. We got some great news this week. USA Today's Whitney Matheson, the writer of Pop Candy and the podcaster who does the Pop Candy podcast, did her top 10 list of comic book podcasts. Word Balloon was number one. My thanks to Whitney. My thanks to Word Balloon listeners who wrote in and suggested our show to Whitney. And congratulations to my friends at 11 O'Clock Comics, iFanboy, Tom vs. Aquaman, Raging Bullets, Indie Spinner Rack, everybody else that was on the top 10 list. It was a fantastic list, well represented, but obviously shocked and very pleased that Word Balloon was chosen as number one. Lots of great names coming up, lots of good conversation, as always. Until next time, if you want to reach me via email, it's john@wordballoon.com. Follow me on Twitter under John Word Balloon, or at Facebook under my name, John Suntress. And don't forget about the Word Balloon hotline. We are there taking your calls, and it's at 312-841-7025. 312-841-7025. You've got 3 minutes to give me your point of view on whatever you want to talk about. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2011.